From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. We conclude our series on hip-hop today. Questlove from The Roots joins us. They're one of the few hip-hop groups that play instruments along with sampling music. Also, a musician who is revered in the world of hip-hop, the RZA. He co-founded the Wu-Tang Clan, a platinum-selling group whose name and style are inspired by martial arts movies and lore. And we'll hear an interview with singer and actor Vernell Bonnaries, who has devoted much of his career to keeping alive the musical traditions of New Orleans. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today we conclude our special hip-hop week and revisit Terry's interviews with the RZA and Questlove of the Roots. But while those are proceeding as scheduled, I'd like to start today's show by saying something about the TV coverage of Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath. As a TV critic, I've been watching it pretty much nonstop since landfall, and watching it on a dozen television sets at once, comparing coverage and images and commentary. My conclusion, after watching so much devastation and repetition, is this. If a natural disaster of this scope brings out the best and sometimes the worst in people, and clearly it does both, it does the same thing to television. The worst of the television coverage came early, as Hurricane Katrina gained strength as it approached the Gulf Coast. Meteorologists were predicting a Category 5 hurricane, the first to hit the continental United States since Camille in 1969, and TV networks and local news outlets dispatched their troops accordingly. By landfall, it was downgraded to Category 4, and by mid-afternoon, was down to a 1. Virtually every TV news outlet reported that New Orleans, in particular, had dodged a serious bullet. Meanwhile, most of the on-air reporters, from local crews in Mississippi and Louisiana to Anderson Cooper on CNN, treated the hurricane-force winds like some sort of weather-related extreme sport. As reporting goes, it's reckless, showy, and often very stupid. You can lock down a camera and take pictures of the increasing winds without having to stand in harm's way yourself. One guy ran from place to place, huddling behind available cover, like a kid playing war. It was satisfying, in a perverse way, when a wind gust knocked him right on his face as he was cavalierly signing off. That night, things began to change quickly and drastically. ABC's Robin Roberts, who grew up in the area, fought back tears when asked whether her family members were safe. They were, but the reality suddenly hit her, and we saw a rare moment of emotional honesty. For a while, pictures were scarce. With all the flooding and power outages, technology was failing the TV crews just as it was failing everyone and everything else. But soon, we began to see the true extent of the devastation. Mother Nature was bad enough. The more you watched TV, though, the more you felt that certain aspects of human nature were even worse. First there was looting, then there was shooting. Despite the heroic efforts of rescue and health workers, the human suffering, and the dramatic footage of rising waters and falling highways, bridges, and buildings, the most indelible images from this disaster, for me, are turning out for the moment to be images of anarchy and lawlessness. In the past few days, TV has gotten better and better at identifying and exploring the real problems. CBS, NBC, and ABC all ran informative primetime specials by midweek, and Ted Koppel on Nightline has acted almost as an advocate for those in New Orleans and elsewhere still without government assistance. Cable News has stayed with the story, and Fox News, with an especially aggressive string of local affiliates from the region, managed time and time again to get fresh footage of affected areas before either CNN or MSNBC. They also showed that footage ad infinitum, but so did every other news outlet. Television at these times brings people together and gives them a chance not only to learn, but to grieve. Sometimes, gleaning new information isn't as important as just devoting attention to it. That goes for the networks, and it also goes for the audience. When the hurricane hit, the coverage was superficial and maddening. By the end of the week, just like the waters in New Orleans, it was much, much deeper. We'll end today's show with a new interview Terry recorded with singer and actor Vernell Bonnaries, who has lifelong roots in New Orleans. But for now, here's our final day of Hip Hop Week. Our guest, Questlove, is the co-founder and drummer of The Roots. In the world of hip-hop, where most music is sampled, The Roots stand out for playing instruments. In GQ, rock critic Tom Moon wrote, quote, "The Roots' vision for black music tears out in radical directions, encompassing jazz, trance, rock, and Brazilian pop. From the beginning, this group of jazz heads and rhyme warriors has done things differently. They're a band, for starters, working in a genre in which musicians were once thought irrelevant. Their orbit has included activist rappers and rock stars, anyone grappling with what it means to be black and alternative, unquote. Here's a track from their CD, Phrenology. This is The Seed 2.0 with guest vocalist Cody Chestnut. Terry spoke to Questlove in 2003. Also known as Amir Thompson, Questlove co-founded The Roots in 1987 when he was a student at the Philadelphia High School for Creative and Performing Arts.
When The Roots first started, you know, hip-hop really wasn't that elaborate an arrangement. I'm talking about hip-hop circa 1984, 85, 86. I mean, it's pretty much just a drum beat, a simple drum beat, and a stab. A stab would be sort of like the exclamation point at the end of a sentence. Bam! You know, it could be scratched in or just like some sort of noise, mm-hmm. an enforcement noise. And, you know, so in high school, pretty much Black Thought, Tariq Trotter, would, you know, come up to me and just name any popular song at that time and point and just say, yo, play Top Billing. And, you know, because it was a drum arrangement, I knew how to play it. And that was, like, the most amazing thing to him. He could play Top Billing. He could play, you know, The Bridge Is Over. He could play, you know, just naming all these songs, and I could play them. I kind of thought it was natural.
Okay, well, I'm going to stop you right there, because that's kind of interesting. Since you came up in the era of sampling, as an actual musician, your friends expected you to basically play the samples. You're still expected
to
play, but you're still expected to play like other people's music.
Right. Well, I mean, that's hip hop is audio pop art, really. It's just a collage of other ideas. And even at the time, I didn't know that, okay, sampling is the proper term for it. For the hip hop nation, pretty much the first introduction to real sampling that we've ever seen was this episode of The Cosby Show when Stevie Wonder runs over the Huxtable's car with his limousine. Well, not that violent, but, you know, he invites them to a studio session. And for the first time, America got to see the process of sampling, in which you say something and it's repeated back to you. And after me and my friend saw that episode, we were begging for whatever that machine was called. We didn't know what it was called. You know, like in our heads, it was sort of like the Flintstone episode where, you know, like the little bird is inside of the machine and recreating the noise. And we didn't know how in the world that happened. So just during Christmas, Casio happened to make a product called an SK1 machine, which allowed you about maybe 3 or 4 seconds worth of sampling time. And, you know, me and all my friends got this little toy keyboard for Christmas. And, you know, you mess around with it a little while. You do all, like all the curse words, you know, and all that stuff. And then you start getting serious about it. And that's when I would like run to the basement where my drum set was and try and cram in 8 bars worth of drum breaks within 3 seconds, which, you know, you have to be pretty fast to do it.
Right.
And then I just, you know, realized the endless possibilities of a sampler.
Well, while we're talking about musicianship and sampling, I thought this would be a good time to play Rock You from your new CD, Phrenology, because you're actually playing on this, but you're playing more or less a rhythm line from Queen's We Will Rock You. But again, you're not sampling
well,
it.
Well, inspired.
You're playing
but,
it,
yeah,
and
we're not,
you're reinterpreting it, too.
It's inspired by it, but some artists are a little iffy about sample clearances, so.
Got it. Anything else you want to say about Rock
You? In case the Lords are listening.
Right. Anything else you want to say about Rock You?
Rock You is just our mission statement. You know, the roots are so associated with just a mellow atmosphere. I thought it was real important to start off the album with an exclamation point, you know. So Rock You is our mission statement for the album.
Okay. That's right.
Okay.
What I'm about to say, I'll probably get y'all niggas in a real strange way. Schmucks, ducks, and half-hearted pranks to clues. Willie Gag, Langston, Hughes, push shanks and crews. I debut to make the news, and I've been killing it since. Still in the trench, buzzing off the chillin' suspense. I want my niggas out that barbed wire, still in the fence. Verbal assassin, I'm a killer, still in the sense. Rhymes is graphic, aiming straight at your mind, then blast that weak. The pieces and particles of fragments, mad vocabulary. Yes, I must confess, I'm like Nitty trying to sink a slug in Elliot's chest. Just taste on that, it's black, you can tell it.
That's The Roots from their new CD, Phrenology. My guest is Questlove, the drummer of the group, and one of the founders. The word niggas is used on the track that we just heard.
Right.
When is it okay with you, and when is it not okay with you to use the word?
You know, I could play the politically correct term and say, you know, well, okay, we know it's wrong, but I mean, but basically, I think with black people, we pretty much will turn any tragedy into a term of endearment. So, you know, is it right? You know, I don't know if it's right or if it's wrong. You know, personally, I don't think that black people haven't made up that term, but I think that we've turned it around and just it's just another, I guess, like colloquialism for brother. To us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What's up, my nigga? How you doing? You know.
Did you grow up with it that way?
Pretty much. I mean, it was natural. I mean, you know the difference between if you're being referred to as, you know, my brother, or if it's using a condescending term,
mm-hmm.
You know.
You started playing drums when you were in high school, yes?
No. Actually,
earlier
I started
than that?
When I was two.
Oh, okay.
I was 2 years old. I started The Roots when I was in high school. My father is an oldies doo-wop singer from the Philadelphia area.
Lee Andrews of Lee Andrews and the Hearts.
Yeah, Lee Andrews and the Hearts. So I pretty much, my childhood is pretty much based just backstage at doo-wop extravaganza shows, you know, like Dick Clark Presents, you know, and it would be like 10 groups, Don and Wine, Harvey and the Moonglows, The Tokens, you name it. If they were from the 50s or the 60s, it would just be a big show at either like Madison Square Garden or the Spectrum or out in the Forum in L.A. So pretty much that's, I grew up backstage
Leandro's,
all these groups.
Leandro's biggest hit, I think, was Teardrops in 1957.
Teardrops.
Yeah.
57. Yeah, 57.
Would you be willing to sing a few lines from it just to refresh listeners' memories?
I wouldn't want to scare your listeners, so.
Okay, well, how about this? How about we play a little bit of it?
We can do that, yeah.
I sit in my room looking out at the rain. My tears are like crystals. They cover my window pane. I'm thinking of our lost romance and how it should have been. Oh, if we only could start over again. I know you never forgive me, dear, for running out on you. wrong to take a chance with somebody new. I sit in my room looking out at the rain. My tears are like crystals, they cover my window pane. I know you never.
Okay, so that's Lee Andrews and the Hearts. So you grew up, you know, backstage and watching your father perform. What sense did it give you of what the music life was like? And then you probably watched your father kind of drop out of sight after the doo-wop era was over. So you also knew what it was like to no longer be in the limelight after having been in it as a young man.
I mean, I was born in the 70s, so pretty much I came along.
Oh, you came along in the...
It really wasn't about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't you often wonder if there's going to be like old school rap shows? Like,
oh, there is right now.
Is there already?
Totally. And the thing with hip hop is the motto for hip hop is definitely here today and gone today. So
yeah, I know what you mean.
Anything under 5 years is pretty much considered old school. This weekend I was listening to a popular New York radio station, and they were like, now, back in the day, Wu-Tang Clan, da-da-da-da, old school. I was like, wait a minute, Wu-Tang, that's 6 years ago.
Right.
It's like 6-7 years ago. You know, old school to me is, okay, maybe we can say, like, Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On, like a song that's definitely over 20 years old or something, you know, near 30 years old. But, yeah, pretty much in the hip-hop, it's here today and it's gone today.
Questlove, speaking to Terry Gross in 2003. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's Hip Hop Week on Fresh Air. Our guest is Questlove, co-founder and drummer of The Roots.
Now, The Roots are from Philly, and for a lot of rappers, like the place they're from becomes like mythologized through their raps.
Right.
What do you think you've done, like, to create a Philadelphia in your music?
Well, Philadelphia had sort of a bad / nondescript reputation between...
In hip-hop, you mean? Because there was the Philly sound before that.
Yeah, I'm just talking in terms of hip-hop.
Mm-hmm,
even though I'll say two of the major important factors of hip-hop history have originated in Philadelphia. Number one, gangster rap. Pretty much there's debate as to whether Ice-T, who's from L.A., or Schoolie D, who's from 52nd and Parkside, was the first quote-unquote gangster rapper. And pretty much anybody that's familiar with Schoolie D can give you pretty much an account of where they were the first time they ever heard his classic, PSK, What Does It Mean? You know, because we just never heard... a rap that explicit. You know, pretty much hip-hop before then was about partying, and, you know, there were some reality rhymes here and there, you know, the message by Grandmaster Flash and Maybe It's Like That by Run DMC. But, you know, pretty much everyone's been, like, politically correct. You didn't hear that much profanity, that much cursing, and that much honesty. You know, Schoolie D talked like your older cousin on the corner. You know, or the guys that you knew down the street on the corner. And, you know, he was very influential to a lot of people, the Beastie Boys, and the list goes on.
So what's your image of Philly in your music?
Well, we had to take that and, well, let me just quickly say that the other important element was the art of DJing. Philadelphia has four very important pioneers in DJing. Jazzy Jeff, DJ Cash Money, DJ Miz and DJ Cheese, all from the tri-state area, and they're pretty much the standard for which DJs today are basing their skills on. When you talk about DJs doing the look mono hand tricks and whatnot.
Okay, and one final question.
Yes.
How come you wear an afro?
Because I'm secretly a chia pet.
I won't sing the theme.
right.
Yeah.
My hair just grows. I come from a family that, you know, I don't have the patience nor the time to go to a barbershop and get it cut every 3 seconds. So my hair just grows. It's always been problematic for me. Just thank God it's in style now. Imagine me trying to get through this hairstyle in the late 80s and the early 90s, you know. Back then I could do a flat top thing, but I keep it. It's my crown, you know. It's sort of symbolic now, but yeah, it was a problem back in the day. You know, people staring at me like, oh my God. You know, now it's no thing because everyone has it.
Besides, you're you, so
yeah, exactly.
You can do it now.
I'm an individual.
That's right. Thank
or
you so much.
One of the Missing Jacksons.
Oh,
all right, thank you.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Tara.
Our interview with Questlove was recorded in 2003. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of The Works of Tom Robbins, including his new hardcover, Wild Ducks Flying Backward, The Short Writings of Tom Robbins. This is NPR. National Public Radio. Coming up, New Orleans native Vernell Bonnaries reflects on what's going on in his city in the aftermath of Katrina. He's dedicated much of his performing career to keeping the musical traditions of that city alive. And Hip Hop Week continues with the RZA. He co-founded the martial arts-influenced rap group, the Wu-Tang Clan. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our hip-hop week concludes now with the RZA. He's the chief composer and producer of the Wu-Tang Clan, which he co-founded in 1992 with his cousin, known as GZA the Genius, and several of their friends, including Method Man and Old Dirty Bastard, who died in 2004. The Wu-Tang Clan's name was taken from a mythical martial arts sword style, said to be exceptionally difficult to master, but unbeatable in battle. The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll says, quote, "The Wu-Tang Clan established a hip-hop empire with street poetics, kung fu mythology, ingenious production, and entrepreneurial savvy. The outfit's rugged beats and top-notch emceeing have taken the two turntables and a mic foundations to its grimiest and arguably most artistic extreme, unquote. The RZA has appeared in the Jim Jarmusch film Coffee and Cigarettes. He has composed music for several films, including Jarmusch's film Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai, and Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill and its sequel. Terry spoke to the RZA in 2005. They started with a track from the Wu-Tang Clan.
I grew up on the crime side, the New York Times side. Staying alive was no job, had second hands. Moms bounced on old men, so then we moved to Shaolin Land. A young youth, you're rocking the gold tooth. Low goose, only way I begin to G-York was drug loot. And let's start it like this, son. Rolling with this one and that one, pulling out gats for fun. But it was just a dream for the team who was a fiend. Started smoking wools at 16 and running up in gates and doing hits for high stakes. Making my way on fire skates. No question, I was speed for cracks and weed. The combination made my eyes bleed. No question, I would flow off and try to get the door.
That's the Wu-Tang Clan. My guest is the RZA. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, y'all.
Now, you know, in addition to being, you know, an MC and to being one of the rappers with Wu-Tang Clan, you were also the chief producer and arranger. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, composing and sampling the music backing for the records? What your approach is to that?
Well, my musical knowledge really came from being a DJ. You know, at the age of 11, I got my first pair of turntables, straight arm techniques, you know what I mean? The hardest ones that you could scratch on. And I was in, building up an extensive record collection. Even as a DJ with a four-track, my production style was similar to the style you hear on 36 Chambers, which was taking something from old soul music to something from a funky drum, you know, whether James Brown or Willie Mitchell-type drum pattern, and then come with maybe a Woody Woodpecker record, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then mix that in with some kind of classical. So I was a kind of DJ that would do that. When I would DJ at parties, you know, when I would interlude between records, I may throw on a Peter Pan quote or something and then throw on a crazy hip-hop gutter beat that makes the crowd go crazy. So when I start producing, I had that same approach.
You know, you do something on some of your music that I think you call a detuned piano. And listening to it, I never knew whether it was an electric piano or what, but it has this really distinctive sound. And in fact, I want to play something from the Jim Jarmusch movie, Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. And you did the score for this movie, and it's really...
Yeah, that was my first score.
Yeah, and it's really wonderful. Let me play the theme from it. That's music from the Jim Jarmusch movie, Ghost Dog, The Way
Ghost
of
Dog.
The Samurai, composed by my guest, the RZA. What are you doing on that? What's the keyboard that we're hearing?
The keyboard that I use for Ghost Dog, I use a combination, but I use mostly, it's a keyboard called the Kurzweil 2500, and there's another keyboard called the Insonic ASR-10. And the Ghost Dog theme, the doo-doo, it sounds like... It was a partial of a flute sample, just taken out just one frequency of it, and then played across the piano. So that was how I came up with that right there, mixed in with some muddy string pads and a muddy string guitar sample. Da-na-na-na. So it was a pretty awkward combination, but the sound of it. But the sound of it is funny. When I made that particular song, the sound of it was to go along with Ghost Dog, had a lot of birds in this movie, you know? And reading, studying music, I read about Peter and the Wolf and how the composer used an instrument to reflect each animal. For instance, when the wolf came, he threw on the trombones. When the bird came, he threw on the flute. So this is why on the Ghost Dog theme, you hear that flute in there, because he had a lot of birds, and when the movie first came on, the bird was flying, so I started with that flute sound, so you could feel that joyfulness, but it's also put into a RZA context. So it's joy mixed with sorrow and morbid.
Morbidity, did you say? Yeah.
Yes.
Well, there's something very eerie about the theme.
Right. I wanted to be like the catcher, you know, the spirituality of the bird, but also to capture like the internal of Ghost Dog. You know what I mean? He's a very troubled individual, really.
So you use the word detuned. What do you mean by detuned, and what is detuned in the music
you know, when a piano gets old, right, and it sits in your studio for a long time, it becomes detuned, meaning, you know, all the notes are maybe not a half step, but maybe a 1/8 of a step just out of tune in the proper chromatic order. And I like that sound. You know, most people come in and go, I need to tune the keyboard, or I need to tune your piano, or tune your guitar. I like it when it's detuned, because that means it's not in the musical harmony according to the theory of music, but yet it has a harmony of its own. And that's something that I use a lot throughout whether I sampled the sound or whether I played it. That's the sound I use a lot.
We're listening to Terry's interview with the RZA. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Son.
We're concluding Hip Hop Week with Terry's 2005 interview with the RZA, co-founder of the Wu-Tang Clan. Let's get back to it.
You know, it's funny, like your influences, you have so many influences musically, but conceptually too. You know, like one of the really big influences in your life is martial arts movies and samurai stories. And what would you say has been the influence of martial arts movies on you as a performer or as an artist?
Oh man, I think martial art movies have given me a tremendous amount of influence and inspiration. I mean, not only from the beautiful fight scenes and the beautiful art they display, but even the storylines and the heroic way that the martial art films pit their characters. You know, you'll see one man fighting 10 men, you know what I mean? Or you'll see three men up against an army, and each one will die for each other no matter what. It's like, I got it, brother, you leave. No, brother, you leave. When you see that kind of loyalty in the film, that inspired me. And also the music and the stings and the stabs that used to come out of nowhere, because a fight scene has to be edited, and so therefore the music had to be edited to match the fight scenes. And they had a very abstract flow of music in these movies. So I had a lot of inspiration on that.
What were the movie theaters that you went to when you were a kid to see the martial art films?
Oh, 42nd Street was flooded with kung fu movies during maybe from the year of 1979 to the year of 1984. I mean, you could go on 42nd Street, and if it was maybe a dozen theaters on that one strip showing, you know, with two or three screens inside these theaters, you could bet that there was at least 15 martial art films on the strip at any given moment. And I'm the kind of kid that would go to the movies and watch three martial art films at one screen, come back the next day, go across the street and watch the three that they had, you know what I mean? And so I was a fiend, and 42nd Street was like the capital of that.
How old were you? You were living in one of the boroughs, either Brooklyn or...
Yeah, Brooklyn and Staten Island, back and forth.
So how old were you when you could go by yourself or with friends on the subway to get to Manhattan?
Well, I'm a street kid. I was riding the subways by myself by the age of 9. New York is like that. You know, growing up with a single parent and a house full of brothers and sisters. I come from a family of 11 brothers and sisters. So you could imagine the kind of independency that fell on some of us as children, you know what I mean? By the time I was 11 years old, I was taking myself and my little 7-year-old brother with me, and my 6-year-old brother, all the way from Brownsville, Brooklyn, to 42nd Street, Manhattan. That's like a 45-minute train ride. And we'll get off and go to the movies. And the movies actually have signs on it, 17 and older only. And I'll have to ask a stranger on the street to buy my tickets and all that just to get inside the theater and sit there and watch some kung fu films. It's strange how the urges of it is like almost as strong as the urge of sex. You know what I mean? When, you know, a sex urge leads men to all kind of foul malpractices, from rape to suicide if a man get his heart broke like that. So imagine that same kind of drive and urge for martial arts and for the study of knowledge and for music and hip-hop. It's like, that's the kind of urges I had. And, man, it was kind of a blind urge, too, because I really didn't understand it until now. I see that, wow, what a path that was chosen for me.
Okay, so you just had this instinctive urge to hear music, to go wherever you had to hear the music you wanted to hear, and to go as far as you needed to see the movies you wanted to see. And that was an incredible education for you, particularly in the field that you are in, which is music.
Yeah, exactly.
And movies, because you write scores for movies. What was actual school like for you, where you were officially supposed to be getting your education?
Well, in school, I made a lot of teachers, they was very impressed with me, but I wasn't a very attendant student, you know what I mean? I mean, any given year, whether it was even living with my mother from poverty and from the times we suffered, you know, with so many brothers and sisters, and it's like, I mean, I would miss 40 days out of any given school year. And when I became a high school student, I basically, you know, the first year, I kind of tried to stay focused, and it was hard. I mean, it was times when I didn't have a nickel to catch the bus to go to school. And the school was maybe like a 45-minute to an hour walk. And, you know, going through all that, the first year, I struggled, and I made the honor roll, and they offered me a scholarship to write. And, you know, I was on the school newspaper and all them things. But by the time my sophomore year, I was a hookie playing, 40-ounce drinking, girl chasing, give up on school, trying to find a way to make a dollar, trying to find a way to hustle. But what saved me, I think, in the long run, was whether I went to school or not, I would always study. So I may wake up at 9 o'clock in the morning and go, I'm not going to school, but still sit there for 2 hours and read and study first before I go outside.
You were writing rhymes. You started writing rhymes when you were about 9, I think.
Yeah, I wrote my first lyric. I stole them from the age of 8 to 9, but at 9, I wrote my first lyric. Yeah.
So do you remember what your first lyric was?
I kind of remember. It was something like, yeah, you see the girl with the biggest breasts. You know what I mean? Oh, I would like to get my hands under her dress. It was definitely straight up, you know, the wrong thing to think about. But, you know, it was sex fantasy.
Even when you were 9?
Oh, man. You could imagine growing up in the hood. I mean, 9 years old, you tried things at 9 years old, yo. I mean, I want to get into my personal life and get psychological, but, I mean, I tried at the age of 9, and I know at the age of 11 I was successful at doing what I wanted to do. By the time I got to 11, I knew many things about women already. Huh. So that's just I think that's just growing up poor. Somebody told me that. I was talking to Quentin Tarantino. We had a long talk about this, right? And he said, I was talking about how my children don't seem to be like me. Like, you know, at the age of 9, I already had marijuana in my system. Drinking 40 ounces, it was only quarts back then, drinking 32 ounces of Old English. And I was only 9 years old, smoking joints and stuff like that. So it's like, I look at my son, I have a 9-year-old son right now. He don't know nothing about nothing. And it seemed like his life is totally oblivious to where I was at that age. And I was talking to Quentin about that, like, you know, trying to like ponder and understand it. And he basically kind of gave me some insight. He said that when you were poor, you don't get a chance to truly live your childhood out. There's so many things on your mind, so many things that's pulling you. And sex is probably one of the best, cures or regression, you know, sex and drugs from the problems of the world. So he pointed that out to me. And I was like, you might be right, because now that my children, you know, they have everything they want, and, you know, they basically the children of a millionaire. And so they play with Godzilla all day. They playing with toys. Right now, when by the time we was 9 or 10, when I grew up, you seen a gun in your hand already, you know?
Well, I really want to thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
The RZA spoke with Terry earlier this year. That concludes our Hip Hop Week series. Today's edition was produced by Patty Leswing. Our project producers for Hip Hop Week were Anne-Marie Baldonado and Ian Chillock. You can find many of these interviews, as well as some hip-hop interviews that we didn't have time for this week, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, a reflection on New Orleans from Vernell Bonneries, a performer who's devoted much of his work to the music and traditions of that city. This is Fresh Air. In thinking about New Orleans this week, we thought about one of Fresh Air's longtime friends, Vernell Bonneries. He's a singer and actor who's dedicated much of his life to studying and keeping alive musical traditions of New Orleans, his hometown. His show One Mo' Time was an evening of black vaudeville set in New Orleans. He's also done a Jelly Roll Morton review and written a book about New Orleans funerals. You may know his work from the movie Ray. He was the choreographer. Vernell now lives much of the time in Manhattan. We wanted to know what he was thinking. Terry spoke to him yesterday.
Vernell, what have you heard so far from friends and family in New Orleans?
My younger sister and my brother are doing well. They left early on Sunday, and they're in Houston. And my older sister and her son were held up in Atlanta. She's coming to my apartment today in New York. To stay for a while and wait on word from her husband and son, who opted to stay. And we got a text message from them days ago that they were doing okay. So we're just hoping that we hear from them very, very soon.
I feel like we're in mourning for the people who have died in the flood and also for the places that have been virtually washed away. Do you feel like you're in mourning for New Orleans as you've known it?
I'm in mourning in the real sense of the word, that I have grief, but I also have a lot of anger. I have anger that 44% of the budget to correct the levees were taken away. And I think a lot of people in New Orleans were left unprotected, knowingly. Secondly, there's this whole thing now about looting. Well, when you have 10,000 people held up in a Superdome, a building that's giving away in the middle of a hurricane, and you have a shortage of food and water for 10,000 people 2 days later in the richest country in the world, so many things are inexplicable to me as far as judgment calls that were made.
From a musical point of view, are there parts of the city or parts of its musical legacy that you're most worried about, that they might have been destroyed in the flood?
Legacy-wise, yes. There's the William Russell Research Center in the Quarter. I don't know how well protected that was. The Tulane University Jazz Archives. I mean, just things that hold centuries, not decades, but centuries of history for New Orleans, and I just hope all of that's protected. As far as the music is concerned, the music goes on. The music wasn't born out of people having spent a day in a shopping mall. It was born from poor people. Excuse me a second. The music was born from poor people's expression of the pain that they were feeling and the life that they were trying to improve. And like P. Ron, who was an uncle of mine in the 20s, was making the music happen. Luckily, the generations that have come around since and grown into normal society, as they call it. I have two cousins, first cousins, that are judges. My nephew is in the state senate. My brother is the mayor's consultant. He's on a he's in charge of the human relations committee in New Orleans. My sister's a medical doctor. My older sister is a 35-year school teacher, veteran of school teaching system. And people have improved their lives remembering the past. And that'll go on. But the music itself has such a base. In other words, it wasn't born to support a dance or to support a happy moment. It was born out of emotional stress that was put into song, and I'm sure we'll have a lot to say in the next decade through the music.
You did a book on New Orleans funerals and on the music that is such a big part of the funeral tradition in New Orleans. How did music become such a big part of that tradition?
Well, originally for the funerals themselves, it was strictly drums that were there to keep the crowd in hand and keep a cadence going so that people could march properly to the funeral site. Then once the burial was done, it was a tradition that you shook as much as you could down the street and wobbled so that the spirit of the dead ancestor wouldn't try to come into you and resume life. So they played a more upbeat sort of beat. And after a while, they started adding in musical instruments to it, and with the idea being to celebrate the release from the miseries of the earth and that you would finally have this green pastures you were looking for.
Have you been thinking about that tradition all this week, faced with so much death in Louisiana and in Mississippi, or does that seem like just totally a different kind of death than...
It's a different kind of death. Death from age, illness. It's... You can celebrate that release. I know with my mother, after Parkinson's for 5 years, we saw that it was time for her to go. And you understand those sort of things. When young people and children are taken from a natural disaster, it's very difficult to find a reason to say, well, let's celebrate their departure.
Do you still have an apartment in New Orleans?
Yeah, I do. I have an apartment in the French Quarter, which stayed miraculously dry. And for the most part, maybe like just up to the knees on the first floor. But I'm on the second floor. And actually, I just sold my apartment in New York.
No.
To move to New Orleans.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, I was going to spend a full time there. So I just moved like half of my stuff down there about 3 weeks ago. And but stuff is stuff. You know, if I could just hear from my nephew and my brother-in-law, then I don't give a damn about stuff.
Oh, I'd love to end our show today with some music from New Orleans. Is there anything that you've been particularly thinking about this week musically?
When the Saints go marching in. Because there'll be a lot of saints marching in when the death toll comes in.
Vernell, I hope you get good news from the people
you
love. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Vernell Bonnery's speaking with Terry yesterday. On Labor Day, we'll devote our program to the musicians and music of New Orleans. Here's the song Vernell suggested, performed at the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival by Mahalia Jackson. She was born and grew up in New Orleans. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
And transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields, online at TIAACREF.org/greatergood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Musical Memories of New Orleans. We'll feature interviews from our archive with musicians from the city whose music reflects the city, including Dr. John, Alan Toussaint, and Harry Connick Jr. Join us on Labor Day for Fresh Air.